Remembering Director John Ford. A statewide film festival this week and next marks the 125th anniversary of the birth of film director John Ford. Ford is the most honored film director in American history, with 5 Oscars, 4 for feature films and 1 for documentary. He was born in Cape Elizabeth and grew up in Portland, the son of Irish immigrants. He would go on to direct some 140 films, many of which starred John Wayne, Henry Fonda, and Maureen O'Hara. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we look back at the life and career of one of the most influential filmmakers in American life. What do you think of the films of John Ford? Which is your favorite? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. And that was some iconic music from John Ford's film, The Searchers. From a childhood in Portland to becoming one of the most celebrated directors of all time, John Ford is certainly one of Maine's most famous sons. He would have been 125 years old on February 1st. Today, we'll discuss Ford's life and his lasting influence. Joining me in the studio, Jonathan Cavallaro, who is associate professor of rhetoric, film, and screen studies at Bates College, and Michael Connolly, the author of Ford in Focus and professor of history and political science at St. Joseph's College. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you heard any stories about John Ford or about his time in Maine? Do you have a favorite among Ford's many films? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you for what I know is going to be a really fun program. And I'm going to start with you, Michael Connolly. Tell us about John Ford's early years in Maine.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer, and it's great to be back here. Also, I want to start by congratulating Jonathan for achieving tenure and promotion at Bates. It's a great
Michael,
thing and
thank you.
Well-deserved. John Ford was born John Martin Feeney in Cape Elizabeth. A lot of people, even in Portland, don't know that. John Ford was always proud of saying, I love the people in Portland. I'm just not sure they love me. But I think that things have changed a lot now. So he grew, well, he was raised in Cape Elizabeth, looking over Higgins Beach. And then at a very young age, he moved up onto Munjoy Hill and lived on Monument Street and then later Sheridan Street. Went to local schools, had tremendous experiences at the Emerson School and then later Portland High School. And the teachers at Portland High School knew that he was too big for the city of Portland and urged him to move on, which he did.
So he was clearly a bright, artistic, energetic young man.
He was like a lot of students. The subjects that he liked, he did very well in. The subjects that he didn't like, he didn't bother with. But teachers at Portland High School knew that he had great, great ability.
Was there any indication, though, at that point that it was going to be film? Because he was raised in the era of silent movies, right?
That's right. And Jonathan will tell you that most of the early films that he did were the silents. But his brother, Francis, proceeded out to Hollywood first and became a very famous director and actor. And he also was the one who changed the Feeney name to Ford for ethnic reasons. Back in the teens and the 1920s, it wasn't really neat to be Irish.
All right. And I want to turn to you, Jonathan, in just a minute. But one more question, Michael. Tell us about John Ford's family. His parents were both Irish immigrants, correct? And his father ran a store near where the statue is today?
Yes. Irish immigrants. But more than that, they were also Gaelic speakers, Irish speakers. They came from one of the 3 parts of Ireland that still today are speaking Irish. So that really made them a very distinguished family. And vis-a-vis the store, I think most of the things that were sold out of there were probably illegal, booze, you know, being prohibited in Maine at the time. But there were a few commodities to buy at the front of the store, I'm sure.
Well, turning to you, John Cavallaro, I want to have you put John Ford in perspective for us. How big of a deal as a director is he, especially for young people listening right now?
They don't get any bigger, I don't think. Ford is widely viewed as maybe one of the five most influential people in the history of movie making. He wasn't just influential on people like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Hollywood directors. He's been influenced people like Akira Kurosawa in Japan, Abbas Kiarostami in Iran, Jean Renoir in France. These are filmmakers that when you look at the pantheon of directors in the history of global cinema, they're at the top, and they all list Ford as one of their influences. In fact, Orson Welles used to say, people ask him, who are your favorite filmmakers? And he said, I like the old masters, and by that I mean John Ford and John Ford and John Ford.
What was he known for? His sweeping landscapes, his westerns in Monument Valley, discovering John Wayne, or is that just a tiny tip of the iceberg?
All of that and more, I think. Visually, he's known for not cutting very much. And I think if you're not paying attention to Ford, you can think that his films are almost boring because he doesn't move the camera. He doesn't cut a lot. It doesn't look like a Marvel movie when you watch a John Ford film. But he was very careful about where he put the camera and very careful about how he used it. And in that way, he was able to capture exactly the perspective he wanted for each film. And when he would cut in for close-ups, they meant more because they weren't that frequent in his films.
How did his background as the son of Irish immigrants influence his work?
I think it was a defining feature just for his life. I mean, I know we're going to be talking about the festival in a little bit, and we're proud at Bates to have the Grapes of Wrath screening. There's a very famous scene in that film where Tom Joad is essentially leaving his family, and he's having a conversation with his mom. He says, you know, she says, how will I know where you are? How will I know what you're up to? How will I know you're okay? And he says, you know, wherever there's a cop beating a guy, I'll be there, wherever hungry people are trying to eat, I'll be there. And he tells this whole story. And Ford has told the story that when he was reading the script and reading the novel preparing for that film, that scene was the one that really connected with him because it made him imagine his Irish parents and what it must have been like for them to leave Ireland and come to the United States back in the 19th century and what it meant that it was a goodbye for possibly ever.
And Michael, from your perspective,
I think that the fact that his parents were Gaelic speakers, as I mentioned before, coming from one of the poorest parts of Ireland, western part of County Galway, better known as Connemara, gave him a sensitivity of what it was like to be poor, to be on the margins, not to be from an elite family or in an elite area. And I think that in almost all of the films, I think Jonathan will agree with this, there were characters that were based on exactly that same kind of lifestyle, and he held them up. They were flawed heroes, like most of us. So I think he had a sensitivity that came from his family background that played out through almost all of his films.
So I watched Stagecoach last night in preparation for the program today. I mean, which of the 140 films to pick? But and it struck me as I thought about the film that there's some irony in that there's an Irish boy from Portland, Maine, who defined, for better and worse, the whole idea of the mythic Western landscape for America.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And he was able to do it not just in that one film, which was incredibly important in the history, not just of his career, but of Westerns in general. But, you know, you look at his career and you see My Darling Clementine and you see The Searchers and you see The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and Fort Apache and Rio Grande. And She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And the list just goes on and on and on. He used to say, I'm John Ford and I direct Westerns. He didn't say I'm a filmmaker. He didn't say I'm a director. He didn't say I make movies. He made Westerns.
Why Westerns? Why was I know he made other films, but why was that how he defined himself?
I think that one thing that I learned when I was at Boston College from my professor there was that even though we in New England consider ourselves the hub of the universe, Maine was also a frontier. And if you think of Bangor and the log drives that used to come down the Penobscot River, so we were living on the edge of New England and certainly on the edge of America. So, and I often think as I look out over the Eastern Promenade that that kind of a panoramic view that he had of the Atlantic Ocean was not that dissimilar from maybe the view that he saw when he was in Monument Valley.
Joining us on the line now, Michael Perreault, the executive director of the Maine Film Center. Thanks for calling in, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
We're doing the show today to coincide with the upcoming film festival. Tell us why you're doing it and what will be offered to audiences. How did you pick out of the 140 films which ones to show and where?
Well, I think this is just an incredible opportunity to celebrate Ford's, you know, as your guests have explained, huge body of films. He started making films that are still being seen more than a century later, and the level of influence that he had on so many filmmakers is huge. So this 125th anniversary is a pretty incredible milestone that really reflects the influence he had not only on film history but on filmmaking. And I think it sets an inspiring example for young and aspiring filmmakers that they can really get started right here in Maine and go on to achieve great things. And on a more, you know, personal note, I'm excited about the opportunity to see some of his films for the first time and shown as they should be, which is on the big screen at a local theater to a crowd of people rather than home alone on a laptop or a phone. Those local cinemas are so important to the communities where they're located because they really do provide spaces and opportunities for people to connect and share in the experience of discovery and to discuss the films that they see. Plus the fact that we have so many experts like the ones on the phone today and community-based organizations and colleges partnering with us for presentations and discussions with each film. It's really going to be an almost once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to engage with these films and to learn about Ford as a filmmaker.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite John Ford film?
I do. I would have to say it's The Searchers, and I'm really excited to see it on 35mm at the Strand in Rockland this Saturday.
And why is The Searchers your favorite?
I think it's one of Ford's most iconic films that, you know, really did go on to influence so many filmmakers just in terms of genre and form and style. You know, the Western has been an incredibly influential genre, and I think the story of The Searchers is a really complicated one that's not, you know, the lead character is an anti-hero, and it takes a lot of discussion and thought to engage with it, and that's what I really appreciate about Ford's work overall.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Michael. Michael Perreault, the executive director of the Maine Film Center. We have posted links to the information about the John Ford Film Festival on our Facebook page and web page. So thanks so much, Michael. I want to ask you, John, when you teach John Ford to young people, Bates College students, what is their reaction to the films?
I always worry about this. The first time I saw a Ford film, I was a freshman or a sophomore in college, and I think I was bored by it because I didn't really understand what was going on. It was my first film class. It was my first screening, and I watched My Darling Clementine and then Tombstone, which is kind of a remake, and I thought Tombstone was infinitely superior back when I was 19 years old. So I worry about it. But I think one of the things that you see in Ford is that some of the things that he's interested in talking about and that he returns to throughout the course of his career are things that still speak to us today. The Grapes of Wrath, for example, is a film that on one level it's about the Okies and it's about the Dust Bowl and it's about the Great Depression. And I think if you frame it that way, it becomes a historical artifact, which it is. But it's also about people who are displaced by a man-made climate disaster. It's about migration and what happens to families when they're separated as a result of migration. It's about income inequality, and these are issues that we're still talking about today. And I think, to my students' credit, they see that. They see that better than I did when I was their age.
Mm.
And Michael actually knows as well, because last time I taught the class, we came down to Portland, and Michael gave us a little tour of all the different places that were important to Ford, and then he was in some of the documentaries that my students put together about Ford. I don't know what your experience was, but that's always been impressive to me that they're able to get at that.
Well, thinking back to one of my first screenings of a Ford film, it was The Quiet Man, and it was at Boston College. So that was at graduate level. I was really unfamiliar with John Ford up until that point. And I remember my professor saying, of course, you'll be at the showing tonight of The Quiet Man. And I said, well, actually, I have something else that I need to do. And he said, oh, you couldn't. You have to come to this. It's so stereotypically Irish. You have to see this. And I think it was eye-opening for me. It really was, especially since a lot of it was set right on the Galway-Mayo border. And that's the area I was familiar with in Ireland.
I know that John Ford is celebrated for his characters not only being interesting on a personal level, but often being archetypes of something bigger. But I was also struck by watching Stagecoach, some of the throwaway lines, or not throwaway lines, but smaller lines also resonate today. For example, the banker says during an argument, we need to have a businessman as president. And I thought to myself, my goodness, this film was made in 1939.
Right. It's 80 years old. And it's still, I think that's one of the things that makes Ford great. But I also think it's one of the things that we as viewers need to have more appreciation of, that a lot of the issues that we're dealing with, this isn't the first time we've been dealing with them. We've been dealing with them repeatedly throughout American history, and there might be something there worth mining and talking about.
And to reflect a little bit more on Stagecoach itself, I think that's my favorite Western. The people on the Stagecoach, and all the action takes place basically within a small little confined area. And the people that are supposed to be the movers and shakers of the society aren't always. And the people who are supposed to be on the outs, the lady of ill repute, etc., are really the ones that have character and backbone to them. And I applaud John Ford for demonstrating this. We all have good character and bad character within us.
And the characters who are in trouble with the law have traumatic childhoods, which is something, again, that we're learning about and talking about here in the 21st century. And that was something he was exploring in his film 80 years ago. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking about the film director, John Ford. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does South Street Linen, dedicated to creating stylish all-season linen clothing for women made in Maine. SouthStreetLinen.com.
Chris Christie was a key member of President Trump's 2016 campaign team. In his new book, Christie says collusion with Russia was unlikely.
This group was still trying to hire field reps in Pennsylvania in August. I hardly think that they were organized enough to put together a Tom Clancy-type operation with Russia.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Chris Christie's book, Let Me Finish, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephanie Land talks about her memoir, Made, chronicling her life after fleeing an abusive relationship. She cleaned houses for a living, lived temporarily in a homeless shelter, and survived with the help of government assistance. She's faced many obstacles as a single working mother. Eventually, she took out a loan, went to college, and became a writer. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the programming, celebrating director John Ford. Joining me in the studio, Michael Connolly, author of Ford in Focus and professor of history and political science at St. Joseph's College, and John Cavallaro, associate professor of rhetoric, film, and screen studies at Bates College. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Tricia Welsh. She is director of the Cinema Studies program at Bowdoin College, where she teaches a course on John Ford. Tricia, thanks for calling in.
I'm a fan of the show. Thanks for asking me to join you.
Oh, you're welcome. So you teach a whole course on John Ford at Bowdoin. What do you focus on in particular?
We try to cover it all. We start with his early work in silent films and go up to pretty much his last films. I show way more films than I show in other classes, so there's a lot of hours of screening, and it just scratches the surface of his wonderful work.
What do you hope that young people come away with after they have seen the films and taken your course?
I'm really interested in film because I'm a film historian, and I come to him from that point of view, and so I'm interested in him as someone who did films about American history as well. So as a cinema historian, he does films, you know, from the earliest days till the 70s, and as a historian of American culture, I'm interested in him as well. He made films about pretty much every period in America. He made films about the Revolution, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, in which he served. He made films about the Korean War, the frontier experience, the immigrant experience. He made several movies about Abraham Lincoln, one a biopic of Lincoln. You know, he engaged with all kinds of things. And so, you know, spending a semester looking at his films is like a short course in American history made by a historian who was always changing his mind, because he had a deepened and more thoughtful approach to very many topics.
And
he came to them.
And how accurate is his depiction of American history?
Not very, I don't think. I think maybe in a large sense he gets the spirit of things right, but he wasn't overly concerned, and I don't think filmmakers need to be overly concerned with the details of history. You know, they're telling stories. That's their obligation, to make a fine film, to make an exciting film that makes us think about issues. But, you know, I loved what I heard just a few minutes ago listening in about, you know, the modern implications of the films that could be seen as historical pieces. Yes, indeed. You know, The Grapes of Wrath is about people displaced by climate change, or climate disaster anyway, income inequality, all that kind of stuff. All those the issues that he dealt with are very much in front of us today as well. And it doesn't take any effort to see that. They're right there. You hear them as you say, you know, as you said, with the Stagecoach line, we need a banker or a businessman as a president. I also watched Stagecoach this weekend and laughed at that line. And my students talk about doing so all the time. You know, that sounded like today. We're talking about that right now.
So before I say goodbye, I have to ask if you have any best or worst Ford films to throw into you're throwing your hat in the ring.
Yeah. I mean, I think the greatest Ford film, in fact, is The Searchers, and for justifiable reason. But my secret favorite is Young Mr. Lincoln, with a young Henry Fonda playing the president before he found his greatness. And the French title of that is Toward His Destiny. But we just call it Young Mr. Lincoln here. And that's a real favorite. It's not on our program for the festival, but if I had one more I could add, I would add that one.
Well, Tricia Welsh, thank you so much for calling in. Tricia Welsh directs the Cinema Studies Program at Bowdoin College. And the reason I misspoke just a little bit there is we have another guest on the line. Cinnamon Catlin Legutko is CEO of the Abbey Museum. And like all our guests today, she will be one of the speakers at the John Ford Film Festival. Cinnamon, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
So tell me about how you perceive of John Ford. You know, many of Ford's films do feature Native Americans. What do you think of how they're depicted?
Well, I have to confess, as a college kid, I did a paper on John Ford and really looked at his portrayal of Native people quite critically, and had the opportunity to study his archives at Indiana University and really understand how deliberate he was in terms of stage or set direction, rather, and costuming to make this more pan-Indian kind of feel. He wasn't as concerned about details. He wasn't as concerned about the Native person as a human being, more as an ominous presence, especially early on in his film work. And then that changes and evolves, as everything does for everyone. But it's really challenging to counter those stereotypes that develop. And this is the birth of that Western stereotype of Native people with John Ford. These are impacts felt today by Native people. When you look back at Westerns and that Cowboys and Indians model, it comes out of that film work. And it's always been something I've studied and considered, especially as I look at film today and consider the impacts for Native people.
Do you know if any of Ford's ideas about Native Americans can be traced to his roots in Maine?
You know, I can't say that for sure. I was really curious about what was said earlier, though, about Portland feeling like a frontier when he was a kid. And I find that quite curious, and I want to think about that more. Definitely this, you know, Stagecoach is the one that I am getting the opportunity to speak about on Sunday at the Criterion in Bar Harbor, is reflective of that pre-war era, of that looming darkness. I think he's more responding to the national field, the national concern sometimes. You know, there's a time and place for a movie to be reborn. And Westerns had been around before, but they had fallen out of favor in the 30s. And by 1939, this one takes the stage and is quite successful. And I think it's responding to the worries of the nation. So he does respond that way more than just exactly where he's from.
What do we know about how the Native Americans who were actors in the films felt about the roles they were playing?
We do know that he hired Native people, especially Navajo people, Diné people, around Monument Valley, which is the land of the Navajo, that is their homeland still, which was exciting. This is a time when there was very little economy, economic opportunity, so being hired to be a stand-in or a character of some sort was important, and they were paid union wages. But certainly, through the years, it wasn't as consistent. At times, Native people were played by Italians and other folks who were non-Native. So you get quite muddled perceptions of how that felt and was experienced. I can say today, though, when you visit Monument Valley, which is one of my favorite places on the planet to travel to, the vestiges of John Ford are still there. It's very much the part of the story when you visit there. So I would say that today the impact is very cautious and aware that Native people carry, but they also understand how it has really created space that is portrayed on a national stage through his impact and through the incorporation of Native people.
And Cinnamon, remind us again when you are speaking during this festival.
So on Sunday, we're doing a screening of Stagecoach at 3 o'clock at the Criterion here in Bar Harbor. And afterwards, we're going to lead a discussion, myself and a couple of my colleagues here from the Abbey, to talk about the impacts of stereotypes that are born out of movies like Stagecoach and others, and really talk about their legacies for today, and especially consider how any kind of film through the years has tracked with stereotypes. It's a curious time and age that we're in now, and we're hoping to generate an evocative discussion on Sunday.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's Cinnamon Catlin Legutko, CEO of the Abbey Museum. And now we're going to hear from John Ford's grandson. He was unable to call into the program today, but left us a message. And here's part of him describing, he says he's always asked what his grandfather is like.
People always ask me, what was John Ford like? What was your grandfather like? To me, he was in charge. He was the heavy-duty father figure of the entire family. And he was eccentric. He was always in motion. He was aloof, yet kind. He was an odd man. And he didn't enjoy retirement. He was a man who needed to keep in motion, keep busy. He wasn't a particularly good husband. He wasn't a particularly good father. He was too busy.
I'm sure, too busy, 140 films.
Absolutely. And it's so good to hear Dan Ford's voice. For many years, Dan kept a cottage out on Peaks Island, just as the Feeney family had done years and years ago, and also wrote a memoir of his grandfather as well. So great to hear his voice. Also, I don't know if Jonathan knows this, but we did a screening of The Searchers down in Congress Square on a great big screen. And it was right in the middle of a busy night with sirens going off and people stumbling and falling. It was almost like being there alive.
We're going to go to a clip of a BBC interview with John Ford. We have a couple clips from that interview. It's a delight to listen to the whole thing because the BBC interviewer is, a little full of himself and a little pretentious, and John Ford's not having any of it. But here's something his grandson just mentioned, as you might have heard. He used the word eccentric, and we're going to address this in this clip.
Everybody has a little eccentricity in that character, I believe. If you ask me to define it, I don't know in what way I'm eccentric. Probably because I'm very courteous to my equals, more than courteous to my inferiors. I'm speaking in terms of pictures. and I'm horribly rude to my superiors, so-called. So that's probably what they mean by eccentric.
I don't think that is what they meant by eccentric. Apparently, during the interview, he's getting up and down and fidgeting and rolling a cigarette. But I thought you would laugh, John, at the part where he says he's very courteous to his inferiors, because he did not have a reputation for being courteous to his actors, did he?
He was not. He was mixed. He could be, and he could not be. He could be pretty brutal to his actors, and there are plenty of stories of him brutalizing them, embarrassing them in front of their peers, and having fights with them. And then there are other times when he's supportive of them, right? So probably the most famous one is he and Fonda worked together so much throughout their careers, and by the time Ford gets around to making Mr. Roberts in 1955, he's directing it, and Fonda's now producing it and starring in it. And Ford's treating the people on the crew badly, and Fonda calls him into his trailer and starts telling him, if you can't, you know, stop treating him this way, I'm going to have to fire you. And Ford punched him, and it then came back in and apologized for it. It was the last time they ever worked together. So he could be very volatile. There's no doubt about that. And he could be very volatile with interviewers, too. You know, one minute he'd be saying, you know, people say I'm the greatest poet of the Western saga. I don't know. I'm not a poet. I don't know what a Western is. I don't know what a saga is. And the next minute he could be saying to Hedda Hopper, I only pose as an illiterate, and I don't want that to get out. But he said it to a Gossip columnist and then said he didn't want it to get out. So, of course, he wanted to get out. So he can be very mercurial. It's very hard to kind of pin him down. Trisha's idea that he's always changing his mind is definitely at the core of him and his movies.
We have an email from Boz. I'm a Bowdoin College senior, and I have a question. If John Ford were alive today, do you think he would have a place in filmmaking? It seems like audiences today heavily favor a more naturalistic style, so I'm wondering if his movies would be commercially viable now. What kind of movies do you think he would be making if he were alive today?
One of the things is, I think, picking up on what Jonathan just said, he would have a hard time working with crews today and union workers. He'd probably be called up for many offenses like that. So I don't even know if he would be asked by producers to be making films
today. Be employable.
Absolutely.
So let's say he were. Let's imagine that he is. Would his style of filmmaking work today?
I think in certain venues. I think he'd be, you know, doing independent films more. He certainly wouldn't be doing, you know, Aquaman or some of the Marvel films. But I think increasingly we're seeing more independent films on our big screens. And they had gone away almost entirely for a while. And now it's nice to see them coming back. And I think there would be a place for Ford there.
We'll go to Bill, who's calling from Freiburg. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a landscape architect, and I became a fan of John Ford when I saw the opening scene from How Green Was My Valley, when he shoots it from the dark side of a hedgerow, and there's an opening in the hedgerow, and it looks out into this bright sunlit valley, and you suddenly understand the difference between the hard scrabble life of the miners and the world that it ought to be. And he had this incredible ability to grasp in a single shot the sense of place and how the sense of place then conveys the essence of the story. And I think of things like the opening scene in Mr. Roberts, where he's trying to capture the sense of what it's like to be alone on the Pacific in a forgotten ship. And you just look at the ocean as he shows the rolling sea, and you realize this sense of immense lostness. Or the great scene from Fort Apache when the troopers are caught by the Indians, surrounded and killed, and he uses nothing but a single shot, showing the Indians swoop in and the sound of their charge. And then all of a sudden the bugle ends, the flag drops, and there's nothing but silence. And it's a single shot, but it captures the whole essence of what it was to be in that place at that time. So I just find that as much as the social implications of his style are discussed and everything, the grandeur of Ford is that he could capture the sense of place and make it part of the story.
John, you're nodding.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that visual style is what defined his work in some ways, and it's not just. For me, he mentioned the caller mentioned a few of my favorite films like Fort Apache and How Green Was My Valley, and I think what Ford does really well and what interests me is this focus on the family and what happens to the family when these outside forces put pressure on it. So the kinds of shots that are being described there accurately are exactly tied to the thematic interest that Ford has. He's showing how these individuals operate in this environment that's going to put pressure on them and their relationships, and how are they going to respond to it? Where are they going to give? Will the family unit fracture? Will it be the armor that protects the characters? It's something that he returns to again and again throughout his career.
Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We are going to take another break, but first a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to be talking about Facebook and what the future holds for this controversial social media platform. If you have comments you'd like to email ahead of time, do so at talk@mainpublic.org. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
The daily stream of developing and breaking news is important for many of us to follow, and we count on and trust public radio to do that job and do it right. Hi, Erwin Gratz here, host of Morning Edition, asking you to do your part on Super Thursday, February 7th. All of us together keep this service alive and able to do what it does each and every day. You can help us toward our goals right now, if you'd like, at mainpublic.org. And thanks.
Super Thursday is coming up February 7th, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
On the next Speaking in Maine, how China's 19th century shapes its present and future.
All of these other aspects of our relationship are sort of founded on the fundamental fact that we need each other for our economies.
Dr. Stephen Platt is a historian of modern China and professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He spoke at the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport about his research on China's history and its relation to the West. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and the music you just heard was from Ford's film, The Quiet Man. Today on the program, a look at the life and legacy of one of Maine's most famous sons, director John Ford. Joining us today, John Cavallaro with Bates College and Michael Connolly with St. Joseph's College. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Want to sneak in one more clip from that BBC interview with John Ford, talking about how hard he works.
It's a nice, easy way of making a living. As we say, if I may drop into the vernacular, it's a piece of pie. It's simple. I've retired for a year. I've never worked so hard in all my life, and I work like a dog. The result is that I'm going to retire from retirement. I'm going back to work. To get for a vacation. You know, making films, I mean, it's fun. It's not hard work.
So it's fun, easy as a piece of pie, John. Do you believe him?
No. It certainly wasn't easy as a piece of pie working for him or working with him, I don't think. He was a guy who could be difficult, as we've mentioned. He was working in an interesting context, an interesting moment in Hollywood history. Prominent at the time was the Production Code Administration, which meant that every film that was made and every script that was ready to be filmed had to be submitted to this board, and they would pass judgment on whether different elements of the film could be in it. So when he was doing Grapes, for example, the novel's commentary on religion, for example, had to be really toned down in order to make it into the movie. So Ford had to deal with that. Then he also had to deal with studio executives who sometimes had opinions on what he should be doing. And he found different ways of dealing with this. So he would shoot only as much film as he needed in order to make sure that the studio couldn't recut the film. And there's this famous scene in How Green Was My Valley where Marina Herrera gets married and she's getting in the car, and the guy that loves her kind of comes into the background of the shot, and he's standing under this tree in silhouette. And the cinematographer said to Ford, should we take a close-up of him? And he said, no, they'll only use it, by which he meant the studio would only cut into that shot. And he wanted to maintain some kind of control over what ended up on the screen. So not only did he have to work with actors, but he was constantly thinking about how he was playing this other game in order to get his vision on the screen.
Going to have a couple emails or a Facebook post and an email about John Wayne. William says, John Wayne, one of the icons of American film and one of the most influential characters in shaping a paradigm of American manhood, which so many American men modeled, was asked how he shaped the character which he played in so many Ford films. And Wayne said, I was just copying John Ford, the person. And then Elaine on Facebook says, love Ford's Westerns for their depth. The Searchers is a favorite. Please talk about the clash between his and John Wayne's politics.
A lot of people looking at John Ford later in his life, his association with Richard Nixon, for example, in the latter years of his political life before having to leave during Watergate, assumed that John Ford always was a conservative. But he had a very, very different role in Hollywood and otherwise earlier on. For example, during the Red Scare of the 1950s, he stood up to some of the more conservative elements and tried to allow for freedom for people to explore themes that they wanted to explore.
He was also very prominent in the guilds out there. So the Directors Guild of America, he was a prominent figure in that. What's frustrating about Ford, I think, for some people, is that his politics move. They aren't the same in the 1930s that they were in the 1960s. And in fact, the way he represents, for example, Native Americans can change drastically in a very short period of time. So if you watch something like Fort Apache in 1947, you see this representation that looks very progressive, very sensitive to the way that Native Americans have been treated by the U.S. government. And then just 3 years later, he makes Rio Grande, and it's one of the more racist representations of Native Americans you're going to find. So he's very difficult to pin down. And I think that makes it difficult to really get at what he thought or what he believed. It seemed to move from film to film.
An email from Brian: when I hear the name John Ford, I immediately think of The Searchers, 1956, troubling, uncomfortable, cruel, racist, murderous, and somehow still the best Western in all of film. A lot of people, including Tricia, believing The Searchers is his best film. We're going to go to Jim calling from Rockport. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
How are you? Enjoying your discussion today. So my favorite John Ford film is a film I kind of discovered one Saturday morning. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, which is kind of interesting because it touches on a lot of themes that we even talk about today. You have a career military man, an insurgent campaign who's dealing with the aftermath of the Confederacy. So I'd love to hear what the panel thinks about the whole Cavalry trilogy.
It's one of my favorites. I love to show that. In fact, when I teach my Ford class, I start the class with Ford Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, in Rio Grande, in part because the representations that are offered are so different. In part because I think, especially She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, the cinematography in that movie is just a gorgeous film to watch. It's shot in color, and everybody wants to talk about the scene where the lightning is in the background that Ford insisted that they keep shooting, even though this thunderstorm was rolling in. But I think that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the visual style in that film. It's beautiful.
I also think that Ford's association with the military was extremely strong, and he did serve actively in the Second World War, filming in the old OSS, and he did receive two Academy Awards for documentaries, one December 7th, and the other one was based on the Battle of Midway.
And he was there.
He was there. He was. I don't know if you could find too many people that were both at Midway and also at Normandy. He was on the second day of Normandy, and he was filming at Midway and, in fact, was wounded there.
Remarkable life. Jim, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Linda calling from Southwest Harbor. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Very interesting. My family, my parents, my whole family are Irish immigrants, so I didn't know that about John Ford. I don't particularly never liked his films, too male-oriented, violent, and patriarchal. But no one's really talking about his family life, his wife, and if he had children. And I just like to note that, of course, he was had a mercurial personality. Most Irish people do. They're mad one moment and kissing and hugging the next. It's a very typical characteristic of the Irish. And it's a very interesting theme right now. We're all immigrants, and we need to deal with that issue. We need major immigrant reform, not shutting down the government. Anyway, thank you, Jennifer, for having this film, and I would like to hear about his family.
Well, thank you, Linda. We can only assume he has kids because we heard from his grandson, Dan.
Absolutely.
But tell me about his family, Michael.
He had two children. He didn't have good relations with them. He was married and did not have a great relationship with his wife. He was tempted to start other relationships along the line, some with very famous actresses. But I think his Irish Catholicism prevented him. But Jonathan was addressing this concept earlier, too, about John Ford's relationship with family. Very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe the films he was making was wish fulfillment, because his actual family was never as strong as some of the families in his films. I think one of relationships that you're alluding to is the one that he had with Katharine Hepburn in the late 30s and early 40s. And it's an interesting moment because it may be the height of Ford's career, right? He's between 39 and 41. He makes Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley and Stagecoach and Young Mr. Lincoln and Drums Along the Mohawk and The Long Voyage Home. These are great films, and he's making them back to back to back, sometimes two in a year. 1939 is one of the great years in the history of movies. The Wizard of Oz and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Gone with the Wind. And Ford has two great films in there, Young Mr. Lincoln and Stagecoach, and another, I think, Drums Along the Mohawk also comes out then. So he's exploring issues of family while he's being tempted by Katharine Hepburn. It's an interesting contrast between his personal life and the life in the movies.
I think without knowing it, Jonathan just coined a new word. I think that's going to be in discussion from now on. Wish fulfillment.
Yeah, fulfillment, is that what I did?
So, Michael, I want to, Linda also brought up his Irish heritage, and he continued. He ended up shooting in Ireland, and the connection to his Irish heritage has outlived his life.
Absolutely. For example, the last Academy Award for The Quiet Man was filmed in his own native County Galway and Mayo as well. And he used family members there, just like with the Navajo people. He gave them work and gave them money. So around Thanksgiving of this year, here in Portland, we had a visit from an Irish filmmaker by the name of Pat Comer, better known in Ireland for his role with the Gaelic football, where he represented the Galway team that won the national championship. And one of the reasons Pat came over here was to see what had we done here in Portland to recognize the Irish filmmaker and to take pictures and bring them back to Ireland and argue that maybe in Spittle, where the grandparents came from, his parents, they should do something similar to that over there.
An email from Victor. Are there any Ford remakes in the plans? I see Gronkowski as lead.
I don't know if anybody ever could dance as well in the Ford films as Gronkowski can.
They don't need to be remade. That's the answer. I don't know if there are, but there shouldn't be. I think that how do you make something like The Grapes of Wrath or How Green Was My Valley better? I don't know.
If someone is listening to this program thinking, boy, I'm going to go to the film festival this week or next and see a film, or maybe I can't make it to the film festival, but this is going to be my incentive to stream a John Ford film on my great big new television. What do you want people to look out for? How can we watch these intelligently here in 2019?
I would say sit with the film. Don't wonder why the film isn't more like the films that are being made today. Appreciate it for the reasons why it was made, and know that Ford was a skilled enough filmmaker that if he wanted to make them with a lot of cuts and a lot of close-ups, he would have done that. He chose to make the films the way he did because he felt that was a way to tell the story without getting in the way of the characters and what was happening before the camera. And I think also, you know, something we've been returning to throughout the program today, this idea that just because these films are set and were made 80 years ago doesn't mean that they don't have relevance to the kind of issues that we're talking about today.
I'd like to credit Tom Wilhite. He's the person that I've been most in touch with about this, and he's been working on this for month after month. And maybe you'll refer to this later, but people who want to go online, www.ford125.com, and they could get the entire list. There's 10 different venues. So all up and down the coast of Maine, people can go and see these films.
Sure, and we're going to have links to that both on our Facebook page and our web page. But, Michael, if someone's going to go see their first Ford film this week, what is the spirit and what is the attitude that you would like them to come into the theater with?
I think Jonathan's asking for them to come in with openness is really the best thing. A lot of people have criticized John Ford for his treatment of, you can list A,
fill
B,
in the
C.
Blank. Yeah.
Absolutely. And these things are true if looked at from a present day context. But think about the context in which they were made and think about the way that they're still resonant today.
And being struck, especially in the early ones, I'm guessing, John, by the fact that we're only a couple years out of the silent movies when he's making these.
Yeah, I mean, in the visual style, that takes place throughout his career. I think that's a huge influence on him. A lot of the things people like me tell our students is show, don't tell. And Ford was a master at that. But to Michael's point, I think it's also, I mean, worth noting that Ford starts making movies about 1917. Women don't have the right to vote until 1919, 1920 in this country. So he's living in a different time, and that doesn't necessarily forgive the representation. I think it's worth talking about how problematic the representations are, but I think we also need to recognize the context within which he's working.
Well, thank you both so much for being here on Maine Calling today. What a great conversation. The voice you just heard, Jonathan Cavallaro, Associate Professor of Rhetoric, Film, and Screen Studies at Bates College, and Michael Connolly, the author of Ford in Focus and Professor of History and Political Science at St. Joseph's College. John Keimel ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.